Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. To watch the news, there seems to be nothing good happening, from our hometowns to Washington and even overseas. A visitor from outer space would likely conclude that all we do is argue and fight, each side believing the others are crazy or idiots. But we also do something else. Some people with opposing views sit down to talk, seeking common ground solutions. And it often works. Take Montana's Flathead Valley, once known for inflammatory arguments and polarizing media. In recent years, some folks have led the way in coming together and solving problems. Paul McKenzie of Stoltz Lumber and Dave Haddon of Headwaters Montana have been leaders in that process. Many thanks to you both for joining us on Home Ground. Paul, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up about 40 miles outside of Boston. My father was an electrical engineer in the defense industry, and my mom was a stay-at-home mom and then turned into a paralegal.
And what did you do in terms of education?
I went to the University of New Hampshire in Dover, New Hampshire, and I got a bachelor's in science in forest management.
Now, what led to interest in forest management coming from Boston?
Well, it's kind of an unusual line of choosing of my career, but I was really interested in the outdoors. I filled out my college application. They asked me what my major was going to be, and there it was on the list. It was forestry, and I checked the box, and I've been in it ever since.
Why does it interest you?
Being outside. The ties to the land. My grandparents were farmers. I've always enjoyed gardening myself and just having that tie to the land, and it's been really important to my family all those years. And so forestry was a good fit for me.
When did you get to Stoltz Lumber?
2003, 13 years ago.
Fair piece of time.
Mm-hmm.
Is Stoltz still family-owned?
We are a family-owned company.
And number of employees?
We have about 120 employees.
And then in terms of your supply for your mill, what percentage roughly for public land, private land?
It's highly variable. It goes from 0 to 50% depending on what's available that year. We have some of our own lands, but only about enough to produce about 15% of what we need for the mill. So the rest comes from private, state, or federal lands.
Dave Haddon, tell us a little about your background.
I grew up in Ohio and Vermont, and I came out to Montana in 1974 to go to college. And majored in
wildlife.
How
did that happen? That's a long way to find college.
I was an outdoor kid, and I looked for places on the map that there was a lot of outdoors, and Montana stood out for sure.
What did you study?
Wildlife biology, zoology.
Why that?
Love animals and love science, and felt that those two fields of study would lead me to an outdoor career.
Why did you love animals? Where did that come from?
Primarily in Vermont. I spent a lot of time hunting and fishing as a kid.
We don't think of Vermont as a hunting or fishing.
The Green Mountain State.
Yeah, it's a beautiful state.
Yeah, a lot of ponds and waterfowl. Love waterfowl.
So you studied that, and anything interesting happened during your academic career?
It was a pretty normal academic career. 4 years of college, I went off to become a carpenter and then a building contractor for 10 years after college, and then went back to school, and got a master's in wildlife.
Your resume says you worked with grizzlies. With whom, and what'd you learn you didn't know about grizzlies?
Well, it was with Chuck Jonkel, Dr. Charles Jonkel, who just passed away recently. And my research was on habitat preferences of grizzly bears. So I worked in the Whitefish Range and the South Fork of the Flathead.
Learn anything you didn't know in advance?
Tons. Chuck was a great mentor, and he was also he had a special way of looking at the world, which was quite different than most people, and help you shape a vision of how to relate to nature in this resource-intensive world.
You say he had a special way of looking at the world. Can you summarize it without doing an injustice to him?
No, Chuck used to say that you need to look at the world through grizzly-colored lenses, and that was a very good summation.
When did you get to the Flathead?
My family and I, we moved up to the Flathead in 1989 from the Missoula Valley.
What was your work when you got to the Flathead?
It was construction, and I also went on to start a canoe business. We built canoes and kayaks, and it was very difficult to get product out of state. That was what did us in.
product out of state? I don't understand.
Canoes. It's very hard to move a big canoe out of state at an affordable rate.
And what's the story with Headwaters Montana?
Headwaters was formed in 2007, and it came out of just a local interest to have a more local presence for the issues that were there in the valley, environmental issues.
In terms of work, what were you doing at that time?
I was working for another conservation organization, and we moved into a number of people in the valley decided to start another organization, and so we started Headwaters.
Were there specific issues that people organized around?
Yes, there are. There are the well-known ones like wilderness, wildlife, clean water, hunting.
But I mean specifically Headwaters.
Well, we were organized primarily around wildlife issues and clean water. We were very interested in the Canadian coal mine proposals north of the border, and we were also interested in the planning issues around the Flathead National Forest.
Now, Paul, I suspect that Stoltz, you and others, had some interest in the forest plan as well.
We certainly do. You know, we're surrounded by 70% federal land, so it's important. Both as neighbors, they join our property, and it's a major supply source for our sawmill.
And Dave, what were you looking for specifically in the forest plan revision?
Well, in the Flathead in the past, the forest plan has been a very contentious process. And it's a large forest, over 2 million acres, I think, close to 2.1 million acres. We knew it wasn't going to be possible to cover the entire forest in a collaborative, so we proposed a collaborative that focused exclusively on the Whitefish Range, which is approximately 300-some thousand acres.
When you say you, we proposed, who's we?
Well, I remember coming to Stoltz's office with a proposal, sort of a draft concept, and proposing that we talk about a collaborative or some kind of agreement where we can get past the divisiveness that is typical of the forest planning process.
I've done some work with forest facilitation, and having somebody from the environmental community walk into a timber company's office and suggest a collaborative qualifies as unusual behavior. Did you have some background in collaboratives at that point? What made you think Stoltz might be receptive? Tell us about it.
I didn't have any direct experience with collaboratives. I've had experience with frustration in the forest planning process. The Flathead Valley, as you may know, went through a very ugly period of really awful, just was awful. And we, our organization, felt that it would be worth making some openings to see if there was a different way of going forward. Of course, collaboratives were being talked about. The Southwest Crown had a collaborative. Maybe there was something, a model that we could use for the Flathead.
Paul, do you remember that incident?
I do remember when Dave came into the office, yeah.
What was the reception before and after?
Well, you know, I'll be honest, you know, you're a little bit skeptical, quite honestly. You know, I mean, you know, I was fairly early on in my career in the Flathead Valley, and there's a lot of preconceived notions that they go along with who people are and what they represent. The fact that Dave wanted to come in and talk about moving ahead and finding solutions and getting away from a forest plan that had 21 amendments to it and was written in 1987 was something that we wanted to listen to.
You said something I think that's critical in these discussions, preconceived notions. My experience is that we tend to identify people with groups. If there are groups that are in opposition to our interests, we tend to define them as oppositional and the people who are members as opponents. If before that meeting, before that time, Dave came to the office, I had asked you to describe the environmental community, what would your definition have been, roughly speaking?
So at that point in time, you know, from our point of view, the environmental community was generally obstructionist in nature. They were not willing to work with us. They didn't understand our point of view from our perspective, and were in, I won't say in the way, but they were in opposition to what we, how we saw we wanted the land managed out there.
And in one respect, you could say, since you're running a business, a timber business, in opposition to your business.
It certainly was a threat to our future.
Okay.
You know, we're a 104-year-old company, and not knowing where our supply is coming for next year it's not a very comfortable.
And I would suggest to people who work for you, that could generate pretty hard feelings, fair?
It does. You know, it affects these folks' pocketbooks when they go home at night. and they don't know where their next job's coming from.
Dave, who did you think you were going to talk to? What was your impression of the other guys?
Well, I think at that time that it was 2010 when we actually first sat down, I think, that I knew Chuck from previous conversations.
Chuck
Rohde from Stoltz, the VP.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know Paul very well at all. And the idea of going in to talk to them wasn't daunting. It was, we have to start somewhere. And Stoltz is here. A lot of the mills in the valley are closed, have closed down. And it seemed like that was, as a local community mill that had been there for 100 and some years, that this was a place to start.
Okay. I appreciate the tactical evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about guys working in the woods for timber mills generally?
I just bought some Stoltz lumber the other day. I mean, it's always, and I was in construction for a long time. I love wildlife. I love wild country. But we live in a society that uses fiber, and they're not the bad guys necessarily.
Okay. Would you agree that some members of the, quote, environmental community might look at them more harshly?
Yes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Paul McKenzie of Stoltz Lumber and Dave Haddon of Headwaters, Montana. So, Paul, you just had this meeting. You're skeptical. What's the reaction afterwards?
Well, you know, I think the meeting actually went better than we'd expected, because it became pretty apparent pretty quick that we're not adversaries, and we're not, what our interests are not necessarily opposing. And that, and quite honestly, there's a lot of things we do agree upon, and that, and if we can work together, our opportunity to find some progress for both of our interests is way better than the historic way of fighting each other over things we don't really need to be fighting about.
Let's talk about the fight before we talk about the transition. You said that it was awful up there. Your Dave said it was awful. I remember some stuff. What enables the transition from, I'll call it, high decibel verbal warfare to let's sit down and talk?
I think we started looking at some more choices. You know, the terrible times we were faced with the either or choice, whether it be timber or recreation, it was somebody winning and somebody losing, somebody getting what they wanted and somebody not getting what they wanted. At least that was the perception. So I think, you know, in the cool down periods, you know, there's some tough times. We had some changes. We lost some mills. We lost some jobs. Potential was still there for that to happen again. And we looked back and said, what we did then didn't work, so let's try something new.
So there was some pragmatism in that last statement.
Without a doubt.
Dave, what were the keys to the transition?
Well, there's a recognition that there's a certain really vocal and angry minority that doesn't represent the center, that doesn't represent most people, and doesn't represent the interests of people. And that particular voice is not good for society. It's always there, but it needs to be contained, and you need to move beyond it. In the terms of the so-called timber wars, everyone was losing, and even though the perception, as Paul pointed out, was other people are winning things while you're losing, in fact, everyone was losing. And
how can everyone lose? In summary.
Okay, well, I'm a wilderness advocate and a wildlife advocate, and we know for decades nothing passed Congress that helped ensure that particular value, and mills were closing. So the two extremes were that, and it wasn't just the environmental movement that was closing mills, there were other things going on as well.
Markets, et cetera.
Markets, et cetera, mechanization, everyone recognizes that, but in the meantime, both sides tended to be vilifying each other. And the idea was to get beyond that. You can't move beyond without having a conversation, having a relationship, and you have to go through that awkward stage of, I'll go talk to Mr. Rohde and Mr. McKenzie, and we'll see what happens. It took 2 years from that initial conversation before the partnerships formed, and then it took a year to get to an agreement.
2 years before a partnership is formed. It has a name?
Yes, the Whitefish Range Partnership.
Okay, and a year to get agreement on the process.
No, we got, the process happened quickly. It took 13 months to get the agreement finalized.
Oh, I see. And the agreement that was reached dealt with what?
We had 13 points of agreement that were recommendations to the Flathead National Forest, and they dealt with everything from timber supply and vegetation management, fire management, streams, fisheries, weeds, wilderness, motorized recreation, backcountry quiet recreation, basically the gamut of issues that most people care about and would engage with on the Forest Service during the forest planning process.
So you start to meet to hammer things out. How often to begin with are you meeting?
We met twice a month.
And what's it like around the table?
Well, to start with, it was a little bit tense. We had a lot of folks in the room that normally maybe would not sit in the room together.
Roughly how many people?
Oh, do you have 25 to start with? Yeah.
Okay, that's a fairly large group. Do you have a facilitator or not?
We did not have a professional facilitator. We had some folks that were willing to help us lead us through the process.
Okay. Dave wants to add something.
I just want to add, we also had Bob Brown, former Secretary of State, gubernatorial governor candidate. He was asked to chair the group, and he did chair it after the first or second meeting. Let me give you an example. We had these different people around the table. There were people from the snowmobile community, from the Woods Products Association, from Stoltz Lumber. We had motorized recreationists who had felt like they'd been cut out of the forest because of trail closures and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And we all knew each other, but we'd been circulating around each other for a long time. And it was the first real sit-down where people were saying, can we do something here? Do people want to try and hammer out an agreement before the forest plan and see if we can get through this? And there was one of the very first things we did as an organization or as a group was work on what our common values were. And we were able to very quickly recognize that we were all at the table for the same reason. We all valued the national forest. We all valued public lands. We all valued fish, wildlife, and the materials that come off the national forest. So there was a broad range of agreement from the outset that we had common values. We just had to explore it further.
In that process of coming to the recognition of shared values, did you feel any surprise?
Only that people, I guess I might have been actually surprised that people wanted to sit around the table and try and work it out.
Paul, what was your reaction?
I would agree. I think we found that there was way more that we agreed upon than we didn't agree upon.
Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't surprise me. Mm. Pragmatically, no, it did not surprise me.
Coming to agreement on a recognition that you share broad and important principles is not the same as hammering out a 13-point agreement where every word matters. You think you said it took a year. What was that process like?
We started off the process with some ground rules. And those ground rules were we had a very defined goal, a very defined timeline, and we had some rules of operation as far as consensus-based decision-making.
Meaning everybody has to agree or can live with it?
Everybody had to be able to live with it. And if you couldn't, you needed to offer up some alternatives and solutions that would help us get to a solution for that point.
So half plus one gets you nowhere.
Correct.
It's unanimous. Okay. And was that important in your mind?
I think it was very important because it kept people at the table, because they had the potential to lose something that they wanted if they weren't willing to work through something that maybe they weren't either involved in or didn't care about or maybe had a different view on it. So it's a matter of keeping people engaged and having some risk. Some personal risk in the game.
Dave, what about you? How did you feel it, see it?
First, I actually wasn't surprised. I think there's a lot more for people to have in common than differences, and we just have to recognize that. But in terms of the process, we were on a strict timeline, and everybody needed to be there and agree on every component of the agreement, or there's no agreement at all. So that just amplifies Paul's point that you needed to be at the table for your interest throughout the process or there was no agreement.
Now, you did this prior to the Forest Service beginning its process, so you'd have something to put on the table, fair?
We did, yes. This is community-driven. We invited the Forest Service to help us as advisors and to provide the sideboards. We didn't want to get too far into the weeds on things that just weren't going to fly because of laws and regulations that we didn't know about or didn't understand. So they were a resource. They did some education for us, gave us a common basis of understanding on the issues, whether it be wildlife or weeds, wild and scenic rivers, what have you. That was really important to allowing the folks to come to a common level of knowledge to be able to work through some of the, the questions and the issues we had.
Okay, now you have no authority whatsoever over the Forest Service as a citizen group. They can do their own thing. They have a history of organizational pride and doing it their way. A lot of the Forest Service staff are interested and maybe not very experienced with working with the collaborative. What indication do you have one way or the other of their responsiveness to your collaborative's suggestions?
So we've seen a proposed action, and for the North Fork area that we worked on, it was pretty well representative of what we had suggested, not entirely, but they certainly took our suggestions to heart in their development of alternatives.
That's a long, tough process, and I would ask you, Dave, first, did people's attitudes toward each other change during the process? If you visualize first meeting, end, we've finished, we've got these goals we've agreed upon.
Yes, there was a marked change in people's relationships over the process. I mean, there's really a lot of truth to the idea of breaking bread with people. There was usually food at these meetings.
Sometimes. Not beer?
There was beer sometimes. But not everybody drank beer. And we had one guy with a black cowboy hat and another guy with a white cowboy hat, so we had the good and the bad represented. But really, in terms of watching people's relationships grow, it was pretty remarkable. Not to say that there weren't some tense moments when we thought that the whole thing was going to collapse. We kept the hardest decisions for the very end, and that's just the human nature. And so we were able to work through some really basic things, weeds, wild and scenic rivers, that kind of thing, pretty quickly. And then we got progressively to the end where we had to deal with the tough issues, and those would be actually veg management wasn't that difficult. Wilderness, mechanized recreation, that's the kind of thing where you saw some real conflict.
Paul, how did you see it?
You know, I guess I was surprised by what I saw as a growth of respect for folks around the room, or at least respect for their values and a better understanding. That's whether it be a mountain biker understanding a little more about timber or a timber guy understanding why people are so passionate about Big W Wilderness. I think we all learned a lot, and that really helped cement those relationships. It wasn't always easy. There was a fair amount of consternation at the very end that we weren't going to get this thing resolved. But because of our timeline and our commitment and some of the sideboards we put together, we didn't have a choice but to keep working, and we did pull it off.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Paul McKenzie of Stoltz Lumber and Dave Haddon of Headwaters, Montana. Well, when this was announced, and I assume in the press, there must have been a generated reaction. What was it?
Well, initially, until people saw the agreement, there was some skepticism. You know, what went on here? Why wasn't I involved? We heard that a lot. We had an open process, but obviously not everybody is either willing or able to participate. I think once we got the agreement out into the open, people had a chance to see it. They saw there was a lot of good work there that they could agree with, too.
When was this released to the public?
November 2014.
Okay. Where are you now? And when I ask that, I mean sort of the feeling of the community, the idea of going forward, moving from a general agreement to more detailed specifics so that you got to fill in a lot of blanks. Optimistic, pessimistic, why? What's the environment up there?
Well, the partnership per se is still meeting to move things forward. With respect to the community, I think we helped bridge some old divides and old wounds, and we need to look forward to projects and implementations of some of the agreements, both through the forest plan and possibly through legislation.
Brian, I just want to make one more point. I think one of the things that incentivized folks to come to the table was that they saw the landscape changing around them, whether they liked it or not, whether it be the widespread mountain pine beetle activity or the large wildfires we're seeing. People understand that putting it in a box on the shelf doesn't mean it's going to be there in the future the way we remember it today. And so being an active part of that decision-making process, getting involved in how our public lands are managed, I think that's an incentive for folks to come to the table.
Is it an incentive for getting community support? Do people understand that who are not at the table?
It is, yes, without a doubt. It gets people that normally don't think about those things to think about it when they see that big cloud of smoke coming over the mountain, or their friends come to the valley and they can't see the views that they wanted to see.
Dave's expression looks like he might have a slightly different point of view.
there's a lot of non-participation on the part of the public in the forest, and so it's important that the people that have the interest and a commitment to those resources get to the table. My point on the collaborative is, and my work for nature is, that we can't achieve conservation without people respecting each other. Call it civil dialogue or whatever. In the Flathead, there's been too much divisiveness, and the only way to get to an agreement and to move forward as a society and affect forest management or whatever has to come through dialogue and has to come through respect.
If that statement is true, and my experience is fairly extensive, and my opinion is it is true, that when we look at national politics, we don't see that. The presidential campaigns are a current example, and a lot of the paralysis and animosity and polarization in Washington reflects a similar approach. How do you guys see that? That they affect the Forest Service, they affect much more than the Forest Service. If this is a viable model for solving problems and they're talking in that polarizing, intense way, what's going to happen?
Well, I think some of us had intentions of going to Washington to help implement some of our agreement. We don't know if that's possible, but I do think that it reflects back to the group or to our community to try and find more solutions locally. I think some solutions need to come from Washington. We may not get them soon, but we need to continue to build the community and the dialogue and the respect and find some local solutions.
Paul?
I would agree, Brian. We've seen local projects that were good projects go to Washington and die. And I think the reason for that is that those folks can't kick the ground. They don't have the buy-in. So that forces us to look for the local solutions and the local implementation. Doesn't mean we may not have to turn to Washington to solve some of the barriers, but we have to be smarter, and it may be a different process and a different packaging for what gets done at that level from what gets done here at the local level.
I guess I would add that if we work together locally, we can actually help the Forest Service recognize that there isn't as much divisiveness as they think, and that there's more agreement and common ground. And I think that helps them put projects forward.
Given your experience here and seeing what happens in Congress, if our congressional delegation was sitting in the room right now, what would you say to them?
I would hope that they would listen hard and respect the work that these collaboratives did. There's a lot of hard work done by a lot of people that do it because they care about it, not because they have to. I think that has some weight, and I think it deserves some real consideration in the decision-making process.
Paul McKenzie, Dave Haddon, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground, and I want to thank you for your work. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.